Benchmark had a very interesting ethos, which was to ask the question, what could go right? Right? It's so easy in venture to say no. When you're saying no 125 times to say yes once, you kind of get in the habit of talking yourself out of things. And so we had a real discipline around trying to talk ourselves into things. During that period, we did the first round in Instagram, the second round in Twitter, the first round in Uber, the first round in Snapchat, the first round in Discord, the first round in Riot. So like, it was crazy. But again, it's that what could go right question.
Well, that was Mitch Lasky talking about, I think, what made him and Benchmark different in their approach to investing in technology and games. What could go right? Isn't that refreshing to hear? What could go right? Yeah.
I like that. I think we should do that.
What could go right with this conversation, Aaron? I don't know. Whew, I mean, it is easier to talk about what could go wrong, isn't it?
It is. And earlier, before we got on the call, we talked about Hollywood. Or not Hollywood, Hawaii, because you were just there. And you said something, and I was like, you know, I didn't really like this about it. And then I thought about that after I walked away and was like, why did I say something negative about that? Like, and I started really like going back and forth. So it's just interesting how you approach, like you could start a conversation or a company in this case, right? Like what could go right? And what, you know what I mean? It's very interesting.
Well, yeah, I think as you know, if anybody is starting a project, starting a company, starting anything, you're doing it because you're excited about what can come out of it. You know, yeah, what could come right. So it makes a lot of sense. We had such a great conversation with Mitch Lasky. Stick around for it. This is another one where we had five solid opening quotes to debate over before picking that one. So there's just lots of good things in this conversation. Funny though, you mentioned things that could go wrong, and I had an experience Sunday. Have you ever had like a travel snafu?
Are you joking?
Okay, so yes, everybody has had travel snafus, right? I've done many things like shown up for a 8 a.m. flight or 7 a.m. flight, but it was really a 7 p.m. flight. I've done that like with my family in tow. So lots of things like that. On Saturday, Aaron, you know, today I am flying overseas to go to a conference.
Exciting. In London, you can't just say conference. You're not going to Utah. You're going to London.
But in any case, on Saturday, I got an invitation to have breakfast with somebody at this event. And it was for Wednesday morning. And I was, oh, great. Yes. Accept. And I realized that my flight was scheduled to arrive Wednesday afternoon. And suddenly I had that moment of panic that I booked my flight on the wrong day.
Oh, because you lose a day when you travel there, right?
Well, it's an overnight flight, so you don't leave on Tuesday to get there on Tuesday. And I've done so much traveling the last month that I've just freaking spaced that out. And I had to change my flight. Luckily, I could change it.
Are you going? Do you fly over the U.S. or do you right? You fly over the U.S. to
It goes. I think it actually goes over Canada.
It's a direct flight?
Yeah.
Wow. Isn't that amazing?
It is. It's crazy.
It is kind of crazy, right?
It's crazy. I'm reading this book right now called Deep Wake. It's about the Lusitania in 1915.
You know? I know about the Lusitania.
Spoiler.
It started a war.
Doesn't end well. But they're talking about, you know, this is how you would go to the UK, is you'd get on a boat and spend like, you know, 10 days on a boat to get there.
Didn't they sink that ship to start a war on purpose? Like they kept telling everybody. It was like there's a whole conspiracy to that. To
get this book is really good, by the way.
Did they talk about that in the book? Did they
talk about it?
Okay. Yeah. Because that was a conspiracy theory for a long time until it was like, all right, we really did it. It's like, isn't that how they usually
work? OG conspiracy. That's good. Yeah, I highly recommend if you like Eric Larson's written a lot of books.
Devil
in the White City.
It's a scary book.
Great Set in Chicago. Great.
I don't think I can recommend that book anymore. It's so gross. Because I started thinking about it. It's like kind of like Resident Evil, you know, like one of my favorite games.
What do you think about murder shows?
I don't like that stuff.
Yeah, my wife and the daughters, they love to watch the murder shows, and I can't
do that. No.
They're too real now.
I'm getting into like cozy stuff, like cozy games, you know, cozy shows.
What's a cozy show?
Those shows where they like a cooking show would be a cozy show. Like I watch a lot of like YouTube stuff, cooking stuff, you know?
Okay.
Isn't that kind of cozy? Because you're just like watching someone cook and they're talking.
Our buddy Steve, so he sent me a link to this YouTube channel, this guy who goes out backpacking in the woods. He goes fishing, catches a fish, and he cooks it up and he eats it. And that's just the whole thing.
Is it just fish?
Yeah, he doesn't like hunt or anything. He picks berries.
Wait, is that the guy I sent you with the really cool knife?
No, that's a different guy, but maybe similar.
That guy is cool. He uses like water from the stream to cook his food. And yeah. Well, it's funny because this is a good segue. I know we're going to go to Mitch now. He's not into cozy stuff. He's into like the opposite of cozy.
That was an interesting revelation. His house style, he called it. There was some good vocab.
Oh, yeah. He has a lot of zingers in there. That's true. A lot of good ones. I put a bunch in my pocket.
Yeah. We'll pick them up after the interview. So here's our chat with Mitch Lasky. If you don't know Mitch, it's our pleasure to introduce you to him. Super influential in the formation of our industry, from some of the biggest console games to mobile to live service and beyond. The whole deal. So here it is. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and we shall see you on the other side.
On the flip.
Thank you for joining this week, everyone. Today, we have someone very special, and I'm going to say pretty unique in our industry. Mitch Lasky is many things. He's been an entrepreneur, founder, and operator. He was an executive at Activision, basically creating the third-party publishing business there. He ran Jamdat, took it public, basically creating the mobile game business. He's probably best known as partner at Benchmark Capital and an investor, having helped launch companies like, and hold on, because this list is bonkers, Riot, Snapchat, Natural Motion, that game company, Manticore, Discord. I think that's just scratching the surface, but you get the idea. He's also an owner of LAFC, so I'm guessing some of those investments did okay, maybe.
Nice.
Hoping you get good tickets. And he's currently the co-host of the Most Excellent Gamecraft podcast. Mitch, great to see you. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Welcome, Mitch.
Great. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Was that an accurate intro? How was my research?
Embarrassing, but accurate. Yeah, that was pretty good, actually.
LAFC, what is that? What is that? Sorry, but what is that?
It's a Major League Soccer team in North America, the first division U.S. professional league. So there was a new franchise that was created back in 2006, and a small group of us, including the Riot founders, came in and acquired the franchise and built a team, built
That's
a stadium.
Awesome.
It's been really fun.
You guys won the cup, didn't you?
Nice.
We did. 2 years ago, we won the cup, and we've been very successful.
Who did you beat in the final match there? Was it Galaxy or was it someone else?
No, we beat Philadelphia to win the cup, and then we lost last year in the final to Columbus, but we made it back to the final 2 years in a row.
Oh, that's impressive. Are you a big soccer fan? Did you grow up playing soccer?
I didn't actually. I grew up playing basketball, but I grew up in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where there was literally nothing to do in the 1970s. And so we got a professional soccer team, the Fort Lauderdale Strikers, back in that era when Pelé played in America with the New York Cosmos.
Now, I grew up in New York and Pelé played for the Cosmos. So that was a lot of fun watching those games back then.
So in the Soccer Bowl, as the really inappropriate promoters of the league back then called it, we played the Galaxy, or I'm sorry, we played the Cosmos in the Soccer Bowl in 1980
in
the final. So that was, I ended up going to a lot of those games with my drunken friends, and we just sort of got the bug of enjoying going to watch sort of the washed up Europeans who came over to play in the U.S. league in those years.
Right. Well, I mean, we have Messi playing the league now, so it must be really interesting business. I'm guessing very different from your experience in video games.
He's in the same playing in the same stadium that we used to go to as kids, Lockhart Stadium, which they've now made over into a temporary stadium for the Miami team. So it is kind of ironic.
That's cool.
Come very, a long way.
Yeah, very, very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, so I was reading a little bit about you, and this is something I didn't know, but it sort of tracks what I know of you and listening to your podcast, which is quite excellent. I'm sure you've gotten a lot of great feedback on it, but listeners, if you want deep dives on how this business really works, Gamecraft is a great podcast to listen to. But the interesting thing that I was reading is you have a law degree and an undergrad degree in history and literature. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
That's a fairly different path into games from a lot of folks.
Wait, history and literature or history in literature?
No, history and literature combined major. Yeah, no, it is a bit weird. It's you know, I was a sciencey, geeky kid growing up, really into computers, etc. And I actually went to college thinking that I was going to study science and went to the science lab on the first couple of days to poke around. And I just didn't like the vibe. And I was walking back to my dorm and saw, you know, these hot girls sitting on the steps of the romance languages department smoking cigarettes. And I was like, all right, man, maybe for 4 years I could try something else.
Hot girls smoking cigarettes. All right. This was, what decade was this? Or are we talking about?
1980, when one could still do that in public.
Right on. And so you grew up in Fort Lauderdale, and then where is this where you're sort of forming your college years?
Yeah, so I went to Harvard undergrad.
Okay. We got a Harvard guy in the house.
Then I got out, graduated in 84, and took a year off to try and figure out what to do. Couldn't figure out what to do, so ended up going to law school.
Okay.
Wow.
So I know a lot of folks who went to law school and didn't end up practicing. You did practice for a little bit, didn't you?
Yeah, I practiced intellectual property law in the technology business. And in fact, it was kind of my introduction to the games business. So I went to a firm in LA and where they had a really sophisticated patent and copyright practice. And one of the first cases I got assigned to was Atari versus Nintendo.
Oh, wow.
Can you talk about it?
Yeah, what was that case?
Yeah, no, it was the case where Atari Games, which was, I guess, a subsidiary of Bushnell's Atari originally, and then was kind of spun off into a pure software division. They reverse engineered the song that the cartridges on the Nintendo Entertainment System would sing to the console to authenticate them. And that way they could produce unauthorized cartridges without Nintendo's approval, and Nintendo sued them for patent infringement, and we defended them and lost.
You defended Atari.
Atari Games, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I gotta imagine that's not the last time somebody has said that sentence. We defended Atari and lost.
And lost, true. But in the process, I had to go around taking depositions from a bunch of people who were really the early inventors of the kind of stand-up arcade console video game business.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of them had come out of the Santa Barbara electrical instruments and scientific instruments department. And so it was really a kind of a quirky group of people. But, you know, that was back in the day when there was no software. Everything was basically hardware. And it was really cool to have a chance to kind of sit down and meet all those people. And I was sort of had to look around and say, you know, I would really much rather be with these people growing up for the next 10 years than be with these lawyers that I have to hang out every day. And so that kind of spurred me to get out of the business and into the video game.
Hot girls smoking cigarettes.
That group that was the technical folks on the game side were probably not the hot girls, but they may have been smoking cigarettes. Maybe.
That's crazy. So did you do more cases for them for Atari, or was that was it?
No, that was the only one. Yeah. We were kind of a firm that you would bring in to do sort of bet the company litigation. So, you know, really big ticket stuff. And so that was just, you know, they brought us in to do just that particular case.
Right on. Okay. Crazy. Well, that is.
So I was only there for maybe 18 months, 2 years, and then moved on.
And you moved on to where?
Disney.
Ooh.
To the Walt Disney
Company. That's right. And were you doing, what kind of work were you doing at Disney then?
So I started in the legal department because that's how I could get a job. And they were at that time forming Disney Interactive for the first time. There was kind of a Disney software group that was primarily doing outbound licensing. at the time. And they had had a big hit just before I got there with Aladdin that they had made with David Parody, if you remember, in the days with Virgin. Virgin Games down in Orange County. Wonderful game. And that game had done like $200 million in revenue, right? And in that year, it would have been like the third highest grossing movie that Disney produced if it had been a movie. And suddenly all of the executives at the Walt Disney Company, and you know, Alex, you've been there, so you kind of know what the politics is like inside of that company. Everybody was like, we can't let the next home video get away. So there was a big internecine battle for who was going to control Interactive.
Right. Okay. And was this like Eisner years?
Yes.
And you ended up in the middle of it from the perspective of how it was going to get organized and formed within the company?
Yes. And it ended up being a bit of a dog's breakfast where like they took the CEO from consumer products and then the operating executives from the studios and they kind of smashed them all together and nobody really got along and it didn't really work out very well.
Wow. Okay. Well, hold on. Let's back up a second because you said something very interesting. You said a dog's breakfast.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with it. And I'd like to expand my lingo.
I grabbed that and I put it in my pocket. I'm like, I'm going to use that.
Yeah, I want to use that. So what's the origin of that phrase?
I don't know what the origin is. I've always used it to mean a big mess, okay. Basically.
That's the polite way of saying a shit show, I guess. I'm gonna remember that. All right. So was there a through line then from the Disney Interactive that was formed then through the one that I kind of experienced in the early aughts? Or was there an up and down in between? Do you know? Do you remember?
I think that they had cycled between primarily external licensing and then bringing it back in-house and then external and internal. Yeah. And like, I think, you know, through the 2000s, I think they were still kind of unsure, I think, of how they were going to do it.
Yeah.
Then ultimately, I think they brought in John Pleasance and Jimmy Pitaro.
Yep.
Who's now running ESPN, and they ran Disney Interactive for a while. It took on a little bit more of an online bent toward the end, so I'm not entirely sure. They've never been entirely successful, really, with their games endeavors.
Yeah. I'm kind of wondering if that through line started with Graham Hopper, who was there when I got there. Like, he kind of brought me in. But does that name?
He wasn't there.
Okay,
when I was
so
there.
That was probably. So yeah. Fascinating company and just how their experience through Interactive, which they're taking kind of a new approach to now, which we're excited about.
Oh,
because it kind of intersects our world a little bit, but amazing company. So how long were you there for? 18 months, is that what you said?
I was again there just for a couple years, but it was a really interesting time because they were really, again, making their first approach to Interactive. They were starting to think about the digital future in a really interesting way. There was a guy there who they hired sort of to be a thinker in residence named Bran Farron, who was really pushing them toward sort of, you know, getting everything digital, making sure getting all the characters turned into 3D models so they could be used in a variety of different contexts. And it was a really interesting time there because they were thinking about potentially going and buying a phone company. They had a plan to go buy Electronic Arts at the time.
Interesting. I wonder if they dusted that off recently. That whole plan.
I can't talk about that, but I do think that they're...
You got all serious. All of a sudden. Well, hold on, Mitch. What are you doing there, though, at this time? So you're hanging out. What are you doing?
So I'm hanging out. I'm helping them do some deals, you know, mostly structuring, you know, putting the thing together in a way that kind of made sense, doing some external third party deals, which kind of leads to the next phase of my approach to the games business. So, I got the idea at that time. I was looking around at, some of the stuff that was going on in the MUD community and other sort of massively or massive, maybe a little bit of a stretch, but multiplayer game communities. Mm-hmm. And I thought, hey, Disney should really be doing a digital theme park. So I went and pitched the strat planning people the idea of putting a team together to go and do some experimentation with a digital theme park. And they sort of patted me on the head and said, you know, that's very nice. Go back to your office and don't bother us anymore. And, I had kind of got the bug in my head. So I left and put a team together and tried to go raise money to build an MMO. This was in 1993, 1994. Okay. So a couple years before Ultima, essentially.
The term MMO was not, I mean, the genre didn't really exist.
No, It didn't exist. In fact, the only real stuff that was happening outside of some real fringe video game activity was in the military, oddly enough, where they were doing these massive simulations, bringing together the tank simulators and the flight simulators and the logistics simulators. Huh. And there used to be a show in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where everybody would get together and sort of plug their stuff together on the floor, and they would all play together in one vast simulation. Huh. And I thought, oh, wow, there's probably a commercial version of this that would be really cool. I mean, you know, World of Tanks today, we you know, is basically that.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, but nobody else in the industry seemed to think it was a very good idea. And I never was able to raise enough money to really get it off the ground, other than a few demos. But in the process, I sort of met everybody in the games business, and the Activision people took pity on me, I guess, and offered me some sort of piecework, so that I, cause I had been out of work and not making money for a fairly long period of time. And so they offered me some work, and that was my bridge into Activision, where I ended up for 5 years.
Two questions before we get to Activision. Was that around the time when, say, like Raph Koster was, you know, working on UO and other early formative things were happening? Was there a community at all there? Did you meet those folks?
I didn't. The closest I got was Rich Hilleman at Electronic Arts, who was working, I guess, with the Origin team in Austin on the early UO stuff. But that was about as close as I got. I met some of the Empath. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, that yeah.
Thing was the console multiplayer platform, and a couple of those people. But no, I never really met any of the people who were working on the real MMOs, like Raph.
Well, it was so early that none of them were out yet, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I guess, you know, UO wasn't until, I guess, 96, 97, something like that.
What's the Empath? Is that a console?
It was a device that hooked up into the console with a sort of ISP backend, and it allowed you to play, you know, really high latency multiplayer games over using your console.
Interesting. That sounds very familiar.
Was that like a phone adapter, basically?
I think so. Yeah, if I remember correctly. But it had gotten venture funding in the Bay Area and was kind of a serious company. I don't think it ultimately succeeded, but there were some relatively big names associated with it.
The second question, which I think might just be interesting for folks to sort of hear your perspective on, partly because post this period of time, you had a very, very successful run, right? So like this company that you started, it sounds like you shut it down at some point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it cratered. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so like what was that? Was it just you? Was it a small team?
I was me and a partner and two people we hired to kind of help us on the engineering and art side, just to do demos and sort of get a prototype together. So it wasn't a huge shutdown basically when we shut it down, but it was, you know, a year plus of my life that, I spent fairly futilely going around trying to get somebody to fund it.
Okay. So you got far enough to sort of have it something that you could be like, hey, here's the idea, but it didn't get funded.
Yeah. We had a design and an idea. Yeah.
Before you ended up at Activision, how did that impact your outlook on like, do I want to be doing this, you know, games?
No, again, like the people I met along the way, the people I met at the various publishers, you know, that was back in the era of Fargo at Interplay and EA's ascendancy, and Activision was kind of just getting started. And my wife had actually gone to work at Activision. She as a game designer, where she remained for like 15 years. Yeah. We met in law school. It's kind of an interesting story. We met in law school. We were both just game nerds. We sort of pooled our money, bought an Amiga, so we could game all our way through law school. We actually wrote a game together in law school. I programmed like in
sort of
nerdy Turbo Pascal or whatever. And
that's amazing. You totally glossed over this, man. That's awesome.
Please tell me you proposed in a code comment in the game.
That's so really cool.
Islands of Kesmai or whatever. No, not, but, But no, and so she had gone to Activision before me, actually, and ended up there for 15 years.
Wow. Wow. So she got the bonus. When you got hired, she got that referral bonus. So what games was she working on? Like, were you working together?
Yeah, we weren't working together early on, but ultimately when I ended up, after a couple of years taking over the studios as a whole at Activision, all on a worldwide basis, then we were working together more closely. But she did... during that period, they were making a lot of those CD-ROM multimedia type games that were movie-like back in the early mid 90s. And so she worked on one of the Zork games.
Oh yeah.
And then she was the lead on their Civilization game. They had the Civ license for a while. So she made, the one non Sid Meier Civ game. And a bunch of other stuff. And then she ran their Greenlight process for quite a while.
Oh, wow.
That's cool.
We'll leave that where it is because there's probably lots of humorous comments we can make about bringing the Greenlight process into the home, but we'll refrain. So your journey then, you described starting in Activision as they were kind enough to throw you some piecework, and you just mentioned ultimately running all studios on a worldwide basis. So how did that happen?
So I went in essentially because they had some third-party contracts with outside development teams that they needed to get done. And I knew how to do that from my days at Disney. And so I offered to do that on a contract basis with them. And once I got in, they sort of realized I was a game nerd and really interested in the design and really interested in the product side. So Bobby and Brian Kelly, Bobby Kotick and Brian Kelly took me aside and said, hey, we want to put together a publishing business where we can publish third-party games. Is that something that might be interesting to you? And I jumped at the opportunity, and they gave me a little tiger team of 7 or 8 people, producers and other administrative folks. And we basically built the third-party business at Activision, which kind of, you know, ended up with id publishing with us and you know, a bunch of other really interesting stuff, and it ended up becoming the largest part of Activision's revenues by the late 90s.
Wow. Our paths may have almost crossed at one point, because I do remember, and it must have been like maybe 95-96, coming out to LA with Howard Marks,
yep,
to meet Bobby and talk about the Marathon games, and ultimately we didn't go down that path. But you must have been there then.
Yeah, it was right around the time I got there, basically.
Yeah, I remember, I think MechWarrior 2 must have been coming out.
Yeah, around just then. Had just come out. Yeah, yeah, it was just about to come out. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so that's amazing, because like that period of time, Activision was much, much smaller.
Yeah, I mean, when my wife went in 94, she was, I think, employee number 35.
Wow.
Whoa.
Wow, wow, wow.
Now they have like 20,000 people or something, don't they? It's huge.
Crazy.
Okay. All right. So you start setting up a publishing operation, and was that?
Yeah. What was the first game, too, with that?
I think the first thing we did was I'm trying to remember what it was, but I don't remember exactly what our first game was. But we published some interesting stuff during that time. We did Nightmare Creatures with Callisto in France. We did Blood Omen. We did Tenchu out of Japan. We did we did Heretic with Raven, whom we then ultimately acquired Madison, Wisconsin, sort of former id collaborators. Ultimately we got id to agree to let us publish originally some Quake and Doom mission packs, and then that sort of blossomed into a much closer relationship. They ended up hiring one of my producers away, Marty Stratton, who was there for, I think he may still be there. I mean, he was there for at least a decade through like the heyday of Quake and Quake 3, Quake 2 and Quake 3 Arena. So we had a really close relationship with them, and that was really what kind of put us on the map.
Right on.
That's awesome.
Was there a slate strategy or any sort of like rubric or guideline for the kinds of things that you would pick up? Or was it just growth? Was growth the focus?
They gave me a lot of autonomy kind of insanely at the time. And my propensity at that point in my career was toward kind of dark, bloody, somewhat violent games. And so, you know, vampire type stuff and shooters and other stuff like that. So we developed a bit of a house style around that kind of, you know, dark, moody, dark games with a lot of violence, and it worked. At that part of the market, those games were doing really well for us. Yeah. And like I said, you know, we ended up, I think by the first year we cracked $500 million in revenue, I think 60% of it was coming from third party.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. And so the house style, as you describe it, was that your own personal taste, or was that where you?
Yeah, I was going to ask the same question.
Yeah.
That like, was what are you into? Dark, moody, bloody games.
I was then. I've matured a bit, but at that point, that
was, and at some point you leave though. But why would you leave? Like, you were a captain of industry.
Yeah, it was one of the best jobs in the video game. I mean, I have to say, running Activision Studios in 2000 was one of the best jobs in the video game business. But, I mean, there's no question about it. But Activision was an interesting culture. It was very marketing driven. And over time, Bobby's impulse was to make it even more marketing driven. And so I always believed that the designers, the creators really drove the industry forward, and that, you know, marketing should essentially, you know, follow. But I think they took a very different approach, really, that they learned from the packaged goods industry, you know, the kind of selling soap and cereal and whatever, that you know, it was all marketing and it was all positioning, and that the content should essentially follow the marketing strategy. And they had a huge success we did in the late 90s, early 2000s with Tony Hawk, which was really a product of that kind of thinking, where it was the marketing department coming to the studios and saying, hey, we think there's a hole in the market where this product could fit, and we know how to market it, and we know who the endorser should be, and we can get a deal done with that person relatively inexpensively, and we can make a lot of money. And so having seen that model work in the Tony Hawk context, they basically tripled down on it. And it was no longer that fun for me. On the one hand, and on the other hand, in 1999, August of 99, I went over to Japan to the Tokyo Game Show, which I had to do kind of every year to go kiss the ring of the Japanese console manufacturers and, you know, do my salams. Yeah. And they, and you know, every year I would go, and on the last Sunday of the show, I would always reserve some time to go walk around the cheap booths, just to kind of see what weird stuff was happening, to see if there were any things we could pick up or whatever. And, you know, if you've ever been and you've ever walked around those cheap booths in those days, it was like girlfriend simulators and tentacle porn and all kinds of other weird stuff you just couldn't bring to, like, there was just no market for it in the United States. But in 99, it was all cell phone games. Because NTT Docomo had just launched this iMode service. And the iMode service allowed for these color screen handsets with downloadable content, and games were blowing up. Interestingly, I listened to your Mike Wilson episode, and you were talking, he mentioned Duango is where he started. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that Duango Bob, after obviously there was no more Duango because, you know, Carmack built networking into his products going forward, and you no longer needed a third party. He went into the mobile business, and he had one of the first big hits on iMode with a fishing game over in Japan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Really?
So it was funny to hear mention of Duango in that context, because they reappeared in the mobile era. So I came back 6 months later, quit my job, and went into the mobile business.
Mm. Wow. Okay, so you saw it in Japan. You're like, this is coming.
Yeah, because we knew, like, in the video game business, Japan was always kind of 20 minutes into the future, right?
Yeah.
And it just had this air of inevitability about it. And I just could understand the narrative of, hey, there's, you know, billions of people who want telecommunications, and this is going to be basically a Trojan horse for us to get a games business to a billion people.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Very smart. I was imagining you had some, you know, internal debate and dilemma around, should I do the cell phone game thing, or should I bring Girlfriend Simulator over to the US? I think you probably made the right call. So you're getting into the mobile game business was Jamdat, right?
Yes.
And did Jamdat exist already when you found it, or did you start it?
So no, I went, it was in an incubator. There were three people basically working on it, four people. And I went in to ostensibly run the incubator, but it happened. I went in right around the time that the internet economy cratered, right? And as a result, everybody was kind of, nobody was really investing aggressively anymore, but there was real promise for that company. And we, after a bunch of discussions and negotiations, we sort of decided it would be useful for me to come in as CEO and take it out of the incubator and try and get it funded. And so I did. So it was kind of working at it even before I got there, basically, but in a much more constrained way. Yeah. I mean, in those days, it was really, they were making like almost like browser games, right, with ASCII art, right? Because that's all you could really do on the handset in the early 2000s.
So when you say that when the internet created, this would have been basically 99 or 2000. Yeah.
So anyway, we took it out and in December of 2000 and raised our first round of financing, and we were off to the races. And, 4 years later, we were public on NASDAQ with, wow, close to a billion dollar valuation. So it was a wild ride.
Oh my gosh.
What are y'all making? Yeah. What's going on there?
There's so many questions. Yeah, hold on though. The initial financing that you raised, was that venture capital?
Okay.
And was that your first experience with venture capital, or had you done? It was. Okay.
I had flirted with it when I was trying to raise money for the MMO back in the early 90s, but I was a real neophyte and didn't understand how it worked. But I was more sophisticated when I reapproached in 2000 and was even in the context of a kind of nuclear winter post in the post dot bomb, was able to put a pretty good round of financing together. We had a financial investor from New York, and then we had Intel, Qualcomm, and Sun Microsystems, if you remember them from the internet days. They were all strategic investors because they all had an interest in seeing mobile technology sort of take off. Sun had J2ME, which was this Java micro edition that they were trying to push as the operating system on mobile phones. Qualcomm had a competing operating system, and Intel was trying to get into the chip business for mobile phones as well at that time.
Was BlackBerry happened around that time too, right?
Like a little later. Yeah.
A little later.
Yeah.
Yeah. BlackBerry was kind of in between flip phones and smartphones, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you haven't seen that movie, by the way, I recommend
it. It's really good.
It's really good.
Yeah.
And now a word from our sponsors. Do you want your game to live forever? To supercharge it with immense powers of endless content, a buzzing gamer community, immortality, and coin? CurseForge 4 Studios, an exclusive service for visionary game developers, allows you to add safe, cross-platform mods to your game and enjoy all the benefits of user-generated content without any of the risks. With CurseForge for Studios, you can harness the creativity of our 165,000 devoted creators and the traffic of 43 million monthly gamers. You can also level up with premium mods and grant your game new revenue streams. Trusted by AAA Studios, CurseForge for Studios is an immortality potion for your game. Enter studios.curseforge.com and join the UGC era.
Leveling up your game dev career but not sure where to start?
Maybe you're trying to break into the industry, looking to connect with other people who are making games.
Consider joining the International Game Developers Association, the IGDA, the world's largest nonprofit, member-driven professional association serving all individuals who create games.
I was in the IGDA in Chicago, met a lot of people, great way to network.
The IGDA exists to support and empower game developers around the world in achieving fulfilling and sustainable careers.
Discounts,
educational and advocacy-based resources,
mentorship,
and solidarity across 160-plus chapters.
To join the IGDA, visit igda.org/membership and use the code IGDA4CURTAIN15, no spaces there,
to get 15% off 1 and 2 year memberships, as well as a student membership.
Joining the IGDA is a great move for your career, and as a nonprofit supporting everyone making games, it's a great move for the whole community. Join today. All right. Well, let's talk about keyboards. You know, I love a good mechanical keyboard. I got a chance to go. Well,
hold on. No. Stop. You were going to send me
what
you said. You were going to send me. That's how the conversation started.
You thought, listen, if you want to get yourself a keyboard,
you could win one, right?
Yeah, you should be following the fourth curtain. You should be on our Discord because we're giving away a High Ground high performance keyboard. These things are fantastic. Go visit highground.co. Check out what they've got going on over there. In fact,
and they sell out.
Discount code for you. They do. They do these drops. They sell out. They do have a section on their site for always available, and those are super cool too. Fourth Curtain 10. That's the code. Get you 10% off over at High Ground. They handed it to me, this keyboard, and I almost dropped it because it's so solid.
It's so heavy.
Yeah. Awesome. They're a great partner. Go head over to their website. Use the discount code to get a 10% off. And we're giving one away too. So follow our Twitter at Fourth Curtain for details on how to win yourself a High Ground keyboard.
And now back to the show.
My recollection is, and you can confirm this or not, is that back in, that's like 25 years ago-ish, venture funding for games was way, way less common than it is today.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. Yeah, that's an understatement. I mean, Don Valentine had done Electronic Arts. Some East Coast firms, I think, had done Microprose way back in the day. But basically, it was incredibly sporadic. There was really no practice of video game investing like there is now, where there's like, you know, 5, 6, 7 dedicated video game funds. Back in those days, it was considered kind of a sideshow, and occasionally something would pop up that they could claim wasn't squarely in the hit driven part of the red ocean part of the industry that they were terrified of. And Jamdak kind of fit into that bucket because it's like, oh, here's a new platform and here's an opportunity to maybe build a new business competition light arena,
right? Yeah.
Compared to, like, you know, funding somebody to go make a PlayStation game, for example.
Right. That seems to me like that's a good strategy for getting funding. I guess that's the blue ocean, right? It's like if you can do something in a part of the market where you don't have competition, then that it sort of reduces the risk factors for success. If you can execute, then, you know, maybe you can be successful and maybe even get a really good head start on folks. Was that sort of the angle? Sounds like that was the angle. Was it easy or was it hard? Did you pitch like 5 and you got 5 yeses, or was it like you did a roadshow and talked to 200 investors?
So the first round was easy because there was still a little bit of, oh, we're not sure how bad the dot-com explosion is. And, you know, there was still a little bit of optimism remaining. The second round of financing was a disaster. I mean, the second round was more like what you described in that latter case. We pitched, my CFO, Michael Marchetti, and I pitched 63 venture firms and strategics and got turned down by everybody. We actually got thrown out of one venture firm's office, basically, and asked to, they
what'd you do? Yeah, what'd you do to get that?
They invited us for lunch, and halfway through our presentation, they basically asked us to take our lunch to the street.
We're going to need to use this room for something more productive.
So what do y'all pitch? I don't know what this is, and maybe the listeners don't either, but what are you pitching? Like, what is Jamdat being sold at this time? Because there wasn't a mobile marketplace. Are you pitching games, or like, are you promising every phone that comes out will have 3 games? What's the pitch?
Starting around 2002, both the US and European major carriers had all decided that they were going to build kind of proto app stores, right? Mm. And that you could download very rudimentary programs, snake-like kinds of things, maybe a little more sophisticated than that. But games was something that everybody wanted to play on their phones. And so they were very anxious to create relationships with potential publishers. And we thought if we could build essentially the Electronic Arts of mobile, right? That was the sort of the bullshit vision that we would try and sell to the venture capitalists. But there was real logic behind it, which was, you know, we we had a group of carriers who were limiting the number of people that they wanted to do business with, because every one of these deals was bespoke that you would do. There was nothing like it is today, where it's like self-serve and right. you know, you're dealing with bots and you mm-hmm. never really talk to a human being. In those days, it was very, you know, go in and negotiate a deal with them on a case by case basis. And we just decided if we could build the biggest surface area of distribution by signing deals with as many carriers as we possibly could and figure out a way to support as many of these incredibly complicated handset models as we possibly could, because every one of them was different. Unlike today, where if you do an Android version and you do an iPhone version, you cover 99% of the market.
Right.
In those days, I think the last year that we were operating before we sold to Electronic Arts, we did something like 200,000 different versions of our games.
Oh my gosh.
And there were only 30 IPs, right? But all the combinatorial possibilities of keyboard layouts, screen sizes, processing capabilities, back-end networks, like every one of them required a different executable.
And how you buy it too, right? Like I remember I had to like text a number to something and then it would like text back another number and then enter that number and then download. It was just, yeah.
It was crazy. But we got to a point around 2004, where we had enough surface area that we could credibly argue that we would get a dollar from every new handset that was sold in the United States, basically as a blended equation of our market share, our price point, and our attach rate across the installed base. So when we took the company public in late 2004, basically the same week as Google, in September of 2004, we argued essentially, don't think of this as a games company. Just think of it as a telecom company. And we're playing the rise of 3G, which at the time was kind of the big data phenomenon in mobile. And we were like, if you believe in data on phones, you kind of have to buy our stock, because we're the only pure play that you can play this phenomenon through. So we ended up with insane investors, like blue chip Wall Street, you know, investors in that deal. We had 18 investment banks covering our IPO, which again, in today's terms, is absurd, right? You'd be lucky to get 6 or 8. And it was just because we sold it as a telecom play.
That is a dollar for every phone. That's some good math. Did you list on NASDAQ and did you ring the bell when you
did?
Yeah.
I did ring the bell. It was super fun, actually.
It must have been awesome.
They had the picture of me in Times Square. Like it was like it was for real.
What's it like taking a company public? I think you're probably the first guest that we've had on the show that has done that, has actually been there and done the IPO. What's it like?
It's daunting, but doable. It's, you know, I think people overestimate how complicated and how scary it is. It's not really that complicated or that scary. And if you have good investment bankers, they kind of teach you how to do it. And, you know, they're doing it 2 or 3 times a week. So for them, it's just, you know, a routine and a ritual. And for you, it's, you know, you're going in, it's the only time you may ever do this in your entire career. So it's a little scary for you, but if you have good guides, it's not so bad. You just have to be very good at telling the story over and over and over and sort of enduring the same questions over and over and over. And you just get really good at it. And I've always enjoyed that part of it, right? I've always enjoyed making the economic argument about why the business was interesting. And you have to be able to do that because they don't really care about the content, right? They could care less really what the games were. They just wanted to understand how this functioned as an economic entity and how they could potentially profit from it. And so as long as you're capable of telling that story, they'll listen.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I gotta imagine, have you sold other companies besides Jamdat?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Many.
I can imagine the IPO this is just my imagination that it's like division championship and IPO like the Super Bowl. Thing. Like it's
the top of the top.
It's less common.
Yeah. I think my partner, Bill Gurley, very famous venture capitalist in Silicon Valley and one of my partners at Benchmark used to say that it was like selling a company is like collegiate basketball, and taking a company public is like the NBA.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So that tracks, similar metaphor. All right. Well, congratulations on that. And then EA bought it.
Yeah. I was only public for, I think, I can't remember, maybe 12 quarters, like, or 10 quarters. And then EA came, it very interesting. Owen Mahoney, who has remained friends of mine for, you know, since then. And I joined the Nexon board recently on his behalf. And, you know, we've had a real collaboration over the last couple of decades, but, he asked for a meeting with me, and I thought he wanted to come and work for me. So I went in thinking that I was going to recruit him to come and join us. And instead he was like, "No, we want to buy you."
That's awesome.
And so you're a public company at that point.
Yeah, which is an interesting and useful way to get to sell your company, because the market ends up having an opinion about what the price is going to be.
Right.
Right. It's not sort of a naked negotiation between the buyer and the seller. And, you know, a lot of times, having sold many companies since, there's always, you know, a dance that you have to do with the buyer and over, you know, how you're going to value the business. Is it going to be revenue? Is it going to be profit? Is it going to be users? Is it going to be growth? It's like, what's the multiple? And, you know, there's all kinds of ephemera essentially around this idea of how to value companies. And one of the nice things about being public is that a lot of that is removed, because your stock is literally being priced every single day by, you know, thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah. Right.
That's and so cool. It's really just a matter of what's the premium over the market price going to be.
Right. That actually is really interesting. Having sold a few companies myself, not at that scale, but you said a few things that just reminded me, and might be interesting for some of our listeners, your opinion on how, like, if you have something that you've built, how you do place a value on it. And the only thing that's kind of, this is super simple, that has occurred to me over the years is it's easy for somebody to look at something they've done and think about what it means to them, how they would value it. It's a little harder to think about what somebody who might be acquiring, what it's worth to them. And often there is a big difference. There could be a very big difference, and it could be a very big favorable difference if you are thinking about, like, what it's actually worth to the market, I guess, you know, to the acquirer. So I'm just curious, in your experience, if you have like any sort of simple ways that you think about placing value on things, which is, in our industry, is very intellectual. It's, you know.
So, I mean, the last 10, 15 years, that's literally been my job, trying to figure out how to turn my relatively small initial investments. I mean, my initial investment in Riot was maybe $5-6 million. I'm trying to turn, and my ultimate return was many, many, many multiples of that, right? And so that is literally what I've been doing for the last 10 to 15 years, is trying to figure out those sort of areas of arbitrage opportunities, if you will, the areas where assets are mispriced, where I can buy low and sell high. And so, yeah, we could talk about it in more depth, but that is almost all I've been thinking about for the last decade.
Okay. So the debt, we're probably, it's probably a little over all of our heads to go too much into all of that depth, but, like, on the level of buy low, sell high, which is probably at the beginning of complexity here, how do you put yourself in the head of, get out of your own head and think about, like, what something's worth to the market? Is that research? Is it, what is it?
All of us who've been around for a while, like, you know, we know how the market functions in a lot of ways. Like, we know who the universe of buyers is, largely, right? And occasionally there's anomalies. So, for example, in very recent times, you had Tencent and NetEase in China come onto the scene with multi-billion-dollar market caps and a real acquisition appetite. And that changed the game in a lot of ways. And they had different things that they were interested in than the traditional Western buyers had historically been, the EAs, the Activisions, the Ubis, et cetera, the Microsofts. At this point, now you have the rise of, let's say, Savvy in Saudi Arabia, for example, a $38 billion pool of capital from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, and they just bought Scopely for $5 billion. And they have their own kind of interesting and unique strategy about how they want to get into the games business on a global basis. And so understanding that psychology and trying to understand how they are thinking about value can really help. I don't want to give away too many of my trade secrets, but one of the things I really like are new CEOs, because when a new CEO takes over one of these big companies, one of the first things they want to do is make their mark. And a lot of times an acquisition is a really interesting way for them to make that mark. So I usually like to be one of the first couple of calls to congratulate the new CEOs when they come.
Okay. This is what I was talking about. Well, then after the acquisition by EA, you are at EA.
Yes. Yes. As the head of mobile and online.
For how long?
For 2 years.
Does that
right up until John Riccitiello came back as CEO. Larry Probst retired and JR came back. And I left just, I think, the day before he arrived to go to Benchmark.
Was that like part of the deal? We buy your company, you become...
No earnout. That's one of the nice, again, one of the nice things about being public, no earnouts.
Right. Okay.
Right. They have to buy all of the stock.
Maybe a tie-up period, but no earnout.
No tie-up period. Got all the cash up front.
Oh, look at you. All right. Good on you.
Day one. So I had no contractual obligation to stay at EA, but I found it fascinating. Like I'd always been interested in EA from outside and how it worked and why it was so successful. And so getting to be on the senior management team there in the inner circle where the decisions were really being made was incredibly interesting.
Oh, yeah. 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 I, too, had a similar fascination with EA. My experience may be a little different from yours. This is all good. All good. No, it's all good. Okay. So 2 years and then.
Yeah. I got a call from the venture fund that had put the final money into Jamdat, Benchmark Capital, who was one of the top five firms in Silicon Valley. And Bill Gurley, who was the partner on my deal, called me and said, "Hey, have you thought about becoming a venture capitalist?" And let's just say I didn't have a great relationship with my venture capitalist when I was an entrepreneur. And so I was kind of like, I'm not so sure about that. Like, I said to him, like, dude, I'm not sure this is such a good idea. Like, I kind of dislike venture capitalists. No offense to you, sir. And he said, no, that's what's going to make you really effective, because all entrepreneurs dislike their venture capitalists, and you'll be able to really, like, you'll be able to relate to them in a different kind of way. Like, your hatred for venture capital may actually be a competitive advantage. And that was such a mind fuck that I was like, okay, dude, I have to try this. So I thought I'll do it for 2 years and I'll see if I like it. And I was there for 12.
Well, what was the first one? The very first deal?
Oh, yeah. What was your first investment?
Interestingly, my first investment was in a company called Vivox, which is now a part of Unity. And it was a voice communication platform for the video game business. And a way to put voice chat into games, basically, as a platform. And it failed. On my watch anyway. But I learned an incredible amount about why it failed, right? Because when the companies you invest in fail in early stage venture, it is painful. It is almost like you're in there failing with them. And all of those learnings came to bear when we pivoted a little company called Hammer and Chisel into something called Discord.
Oh, yeah.
Because all of those mistakes that I made with Vivox, I corrected with Discord. And
Discord's awesome, and by the way.
Discord has turned out to be a real banger.
Oh, yeah.
A real
banger
of an app. We use it daily.
We run our company on Discord. You know, Jason Citrone, it was coming up with Hammer and Chisel when we were starting Industrial Toys. So we fought in some of the same, fought some of the same battles in that time
both
period.
Tablet oriented, right?
Yeah. Do you have any idea how many investments you've done through your tenure at Benchmark?
I think I did 14 or 15 in the 12 years, which is pretty normal for a Benchmark partner. About we usually average about one a year. So, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. It's like, I probably looked at 150 opportunities to do one.
Wow. And how would you...
Yeah, how do you decide?
It's a practice that you learn, right? And you sort of learn what makes a good venture investment. When I came in, I had no idea. None. I was terrible at the job for the first couple of years. As they say, my yardstick wasn't appropriately calibrated. So I was, I thought it was kind of... I mean, it is a needle in a haystack kind of business, but I thought it was even... You know, so I came in with that idea, and then I started to hear pitches, but I was hearing them through the ears of an operator, somebody who ran businesses. And people would pitch me stuff, and I'd be like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like, I could see how that might work, right? Like, if you change this and whatever. And my partners were like, no. You're not allowed to think that way. You're not allowed to think about companies that like would work if you fix them. Right? You're not the CEO of these companies. There's another person who's the CEO. And so you really have to be narrowing your focus down to those things that have that magic combination of great market, great product, great founder. And those are remarkably rare.
Huh. That makes it sound fairly simple.
It's not. I wish it was. It looks simple from the outside. I have to say, I had the same impression when I was like, well, how hard could this be? And it turns out it's really hard. It's really hard to do it consistently over time, right? Yeah, there's plenty of broken clocks in the venture business where a partner, you know, has one successful investment out of 10. And thankfully, the scale of some of these wins is so large that they can coast on that one win for a really long time.
Right.
But the what really separates the great investors from the merely good investors is the repeatability.
Yeah.
Is having done it multiple times over a period of years.
Yeah. So, I mean, just in the intro, you know, I rattled off many, many companies that you've been involved with and invested in that have been very successful. So my assumption is that your hit rate is higher than average. What do you do differently?
So on the one hand, I had the games business more or less to myself with Bing Gordon for a long period of time. There were not a lot of investors who were willing to do it. And so there were really good returns to be made in the games business in that period. And so I had a couple of those that worked. And then, you know, I listen, I try and keep an open mind. And so something like Snapchat, for example, which when we invested was extremely early, right? I was really the first outside board member of the company. They were still all, when I first went to visit Evan, he was running it out of his dad's house in LA, and the entire team was sitting around the dining room table in his in the house with their computers kind of back to back. So it was like 12 people.
Wow.
So, you know, you just have to be really open-minded. And again, Benchmark had a very interesting ethos, which was to ask the question, what could go right? Right? It's so easy in venture to say no. When you're saying no 125 times to say yes once, you kind of get in the habit of talking yourself out of things. Hmm. And so we had a real discipline around trying to talk ourselves into things. Because, you know, you had to maintain a level of kind of almost childlike optimism in order to do it successfully. And look, I benefited tremendously from being around some of the smartest people I've ever worked with in my life during that period when we were at our heyday. But we did the first round in Instagram, the second round in Twitter, the first round in Uber, the first round in Snapchat, the first round in Discord, the first round in Riot, and five other things you've never heard of that were multi-billion dollar enterprise software exits, right? Wow. So like, it was crazy.
That's awesome.
But again, it's that what could go right question.
Yeah. Do you ever, like when you're looking at investments, do you ever have an internal conflict of like, this seems like this could be a really huge moneymaker, but I'm not sure like where this is going to take society, you know, or something like that. Do you ever have that angst?
I do. I think it's really important to have things that are sort of out of bounds, right? And there are plenty of things that I've looked at over the years. There have been, let's take the Web3 space, for example, right? Just naked grift, right? In the Web3 space where people are like floating these tokens. They're almost like Kickstarters where they're funding some future game that they're going to make based on the token sales or whatever. It's like, I wouldn't go near those things, right? Like, I just think those things are sort of morally out of bounds because they seem to me just like scams. But look, a lot of these ethical questions are coming up these days in the AI context.
Yeah.
Where my approach to AI in the games business is in an area where I believe it will actually affect labor in the games business. I mean, I really do believe that it will reduce some existing job opportunities, some maybe potentially very significantly in the games business. And I am really cognizant of it. And I do think about it quite a bit, right? But I do think there is a certain inevitability to it. And perhaps it will be a long-term benefit, right? In the same way that a lot of labor-saving devices and techniques and other things over human history have been short-term disruptive. And of course, the Luddites were throwing wooden shoes into factory machines in England, and maybe they were right on a certain level to do so. But there is a certain inevitability to it. And I think I'm also trying to figure out a way that we can profit from it responsibly.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. I got to say, my experience with AI so far, like I've had a lot of those same kind of fears. But for me personally, as I've been using various tools like Midjourney and contemplating features for games that rely on AI, like what I'm using it for is for doing things that I haven't been able to do before. It's not like I'm doing stuff that a person would have done for me. It's like kind of opening up incremental worker opportunity. And I'm an optimistic person. I have the hope that that's where AI sort of leads us, is to, we talked to Lauren Lanning the other day from Oddworld, who got a start in CGI right when Pixar was coming up. And he sort of had the same POV of like, it's a tool and embrace it or you'd be left behind. And the future with it hopefully is more interesting and there's more opportunities for everybody. We'll see.
Although we are seeing some pretty remarkable examples early where, teams that have embraced it from the very beginning, right? And so they're using Copilot on the coding side. They're using, Midjourney like generative AI for textures and other things like that. They're using internally developed things for level layout, for example, and other things for testing, and like in a bunch of stuff in the pipeline, they're reducing headcount by like an order of magnitude, right? From like 100 people to 10. And that's pretty remarkable.
In some ways, that company might not exist at all without those tools.
Indeed. And I think it means a lot more companies potentially get funded because, one of the things that's been somewhat distressing to me toward the end of the sort of zero interest rate era that ended in the, late or early 2023, but sort of 2019 to 2022, money was really loose, right? In capitalism in general and in the video game business in specific. And a bunch of companies got started that raised $30, $50, $100 million in venture and built huge teams and just, went on the march. And, if those things don't work out, and I think many of them won't, just as an outside observer, that could really, really reduce the pool for everybody. And so I think, being able to make really high quality product, but potentially at lower cost, may actually invite more people into the industry and more money into investing in the industry than perhaps, where the path we're currently on.
Yeah.
And more rest too. No weekends Indeed. Working, yeah. No crunch.
Somehow I don't think that's going to happen. Crunch is inevitable.
Yeah. All right. You heard it here. what are you most excited about looking ahead for the games industry?
I'm looking forward to just the variety of product that all of this sort of modern investment is going to be able to bring. I've come from the era of the big studio system where the EAs and Activisions were dominant. And, in order to make a game, in order to make something interesting and weird and quirky in that environment, was largely impossible. right? I mean, it was it occasionally would happen, but it was very difficult, right? Because those companies are just driven by Wall Street and by marketing and all kinds of other things that aren't conducive to experimentation, right? And so the rise of Steam and the rise of the iOS and Google Play Store have really democratized access to customers in a way that's allowed for a huge amount of experimentation and different paths through the games business. And I think that's wonderful. I think that's been one of the great things of the last part of my career, the last 10 or 15 years, is just, you know, the variety of content that's available. I was talking to the guys from Annapurna Interactive a couple of days ago at GDC, and we were talking about Stray. Think about that game, right? It's like that game did big business, and it's a cat in an urban environment scratching so around, cool. right? I mean, it's like, try pitching that to Bobby Kotick in 1999 or Larry Probst in 2005, right? It's just, it's
you'd not have your lunch happen. Out on the sidewalk all over again.
Exactly. So I think that's wonderful. And again, I don't want to lose that in all of these other aspects of the conversation. And I want to see that continue. And I'd like to see those companies get access to funding and, in particular, figure out paths to distribution, because I think that is the choke point currently that's limiting a lot of opportunity in the market. Is, yeah, you can get onto Steam, but that's just the beginning of the problem, right?
Right.
How do you get that first million customers? And that's an increasingly difficult bottleneck, given just how much content is out there, how you're competing for eyeballs with so many different kinds of entertainment activities these days. And so I think that's the challenge I've been focusing on a lot over the last couple of years, is just the distribution side of the business.
Right on. But it does seem like there has been a really nice kind of almost renaissance in creativity on that indie Steam side.
It's awesome.
It's
and yeah, Switch. There's so many games. It's awesome. And then like Game Pass, it's the best.
All right, Mitch, we kept you well over an hour. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. What an awesome conversation. And congrats on all the success over the years and everything, and your contribution just to the business. You know, I think a lot of us wouldn't have the playground to play in the way it is if you weren't around. So thank you.
Thank you.
We'll see you around.
See you, Mitch.
How awesome to have Mitch as a guest and to chat and to hang out. What a cool cat.
Yeah, very cool. Well, I was going to say, after we started recording, he just like invited you to the soccer game. You going to go?
You know, I grew up playing soccer. I was like one of those weird kids in the 80s, you know, who was
the only one.
Everybody plays soccer in the U.S. now, but back in the 80s wasn't the case. But anyways, I loved his phrase, dog's breakfast. I hadn't heard that
one before.
That's
a good one.
I made a note of that.
What was the other one? Dog's breakfast. There was
here was another one. When he went to Tokyo Game Show and he was talking about girlfriend simulators and tentacle porn. That was
never
another.
Heard that before?
I hadn't heard that phrase before.
Alex, bro, that's like early 2000s, man. You got to get online. But it so Mitch retired? I didn't know he was done.
You know, who knows what retired really means, you know? He's doing a podcast, so he's not, like, doing nothing.
Do you think you'll ever retire?
Me? What does that mean? What does that word mean? I don't think I'll ever not be doing stuff.
Could you? Could you retire? Could you be forced to lay in green pastures?
Sort of sounds like dying. I don't know. What do you mean by that?
Like, being just, like, being pushed, like, being, you are being made to understand full relaxation, like to be at peace, and you know what I mean, and if you get that from like drinking too much or working too much, or you know, you could do something too, you know what I mean, and you find peace in that.
Okay, I know what you mean. I can, and this past week I had moments of that. When we're doing what we're doing, it's kind of hard to sustain that because you have feelings of guilt.
So you can't do it.
No, but I can imagine, because I have had stretches where I have kind of tapped out of something and I've had a stretch, but at least my mind doesn't work that way. I can't live that way. My mind seeks out the unknown. I think that's what it was. And I've told this story before, but it's entirely the reason why I when I was at Disney, a fantastic company, great people, an amazing environment. But I had a moment when I was there where I saw my future, and it was, and I think for many people, maybe that can be comforting, but for me, it was terrifying.
You need a machete and you need a jungle.
Yeah, I need unknown. I need a frontier. You know, so I guess I'm just glad I live in the modern times when, you know, we don't have to like get in a covered wagon and try to cross the Rockies. Cause
yeah, but that was simpler. That was like find food. Now you're going to have all this AI stuff and robots. And what is it then? You know, like when you have all this, like, you know what I mean?
True. Another book I'm reading, The Moon. The Moon's a Harsh Mistress. Harsh Mistress.
The Mistress.
Harsh, yeah. Mistress. Say that 10 times fast. But yeah, I mean, that made me think. I mean, that book was written decades ago and
75 years ago.
No, not that long ago. Heinlein? He wrote it, what, the 60s, 70s? We should look it up when that was written. But decades ago, before the modern computer era, and it's very prescient in its description.
Prescient. What does that mean? I don't know that word.
Like future telling, you know? Like,
don't say it all in the... No one uses the word prescient, dude.
That's not our kind of jam, I guess, all right? Okay, all right. Brand correction right there.
Dog's breakfast and prescient. Those are my two for this podcast.
But an interesting read. Yeah. You know, I was also unaware of how many big influential businesses that Benchmark and Mitch helped launch.
Yeah.
You know, like Riot has such a big impact on gamers.
In the industry.
In my house, too. Yeah, same with Discord. And then you get to Instagram. Other things like Uber and Insta and Snapchat, and just completely global, and just the amount of impact is crazy. What got me super excited about mobile, and what has me super excited about UGC, is just how global those platforms can be. And it's just amazing to, like, the globalization on a technology, it has its positives, it has its negatives, for sure. But the ability for us all to be connected and to make things like gaming so accessible across the globe is, I think that's super cool. And just really impressive how influential Mitch has been, and I'm sure will continue to be in opening up technology and entertainment for to be more accessible and for a global audience. Pretty cool. Some might say that was a kind of prescient too.
You know, I was going to say that I'm on this weird kick right now of going not easily accessible.
Yeah, you're trying to get offline, right?
And it's very, very hard. Like even like a game that is like a cartridge, when you get it now and you put it in your system, it's like, you have to install the update or something. And it's like, update, I just bought this. Like, why is there an, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just so, like, whenever you used to make games, it was like the marathon, like, and all that stuff, right? Even before that. Like, getting an update.
Yeah. Oh, you had to, like, what was on the disc was what was on the disc. Like, you had to test that thing pretty good because... didn't get a second shot.
People didn't have internet too, like, you know, the whole, like, so it's very interesting now that, like, even if you're trying to get offline, you're still online. Like, it's getting to the point where it's almost impossible. You know, like, you buy a new computer, it has to connect to the internet, you know, you like everything.
Yeah, I think I'm sure that's going to be a movement.
Oh, I think it is. Yeah,
you know, probably is. You probably know about it, right? Is there a Luddite movement?
Luddite.
Like, you know, how to be offline?
I would say it's, is Luddite derogatory, though?
Oh, I apologize if it is.
I've heard it as like an insult, maybe. Anyways, well, there is people that are trying to go, a lot of people are complaining that it's not real. Like, it's still very, like, I got the Playdate, you know, that little analog console.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's very creative. There's a lot of neat content on there that It's like almost like the rumor when the Wii came out, there was all this like creative or the DS, creative ways of making games. So it's a lot of that, but you're still online. Like you still have to connect and download the games. Mm. And I don't know. It's just, it's very weird how everything is online.
It's convenient though.
Oh, it's nice.
It is convenient.
But what is, like, do you remember what it was like before everything?
Yeah, when you'd have to actually have a map and plan how to get somewhere before you left the house to get in your car. Yeah, I remember that.
Very interesting. I'm not trying to be a Debbie Downer here.
On that note, thank you everybody for joining us this week. Hope you enjoyed our conversation with the mighty Mitch Lasky, and we shall see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Fourth Curtain Podcast. The Fourth Curtain is a production of Fourth Curtain Media with community management by Doug Zartman. Lovingly edited and mastered by Brian Hensley at Noise Floor Sound Solutions in Chicago. To get a peek at upcoming episodes or to send in questions to the show, visit our site at thefourthcurtain.com. And be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening.